let me get this straight. If the indictment is... if the indictment is, and I have seen you say this, that crossfire reduces everything, as I said in the intro, to left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
Stop.
Why do we have to fight?
Why do you argue?
We're in bad shape, fellas.
We need help from the media, and they're hurting us. You're doing theater when you should be doing debate.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's biweekly show on popular culture, politics, and the relationship between mass media and public opinion. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and every second and fourth Wednesday mornings, I'll be joined by a series of guests as we take a look at everything from the makeup of the Supreme Court to upcoming elections and to how social and political climates impact our view of the future in film and television. Under Surveillance is broadcast on WLEW, a listener-supported community radio. And for more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. From the acid craze of the Woodstock era to the Just Say No campaign of former First Lady Nancy Reagan, drugs have woven their way into American culture since the advent of mass media. The French Connection and Miami Vice brought the narcotics war to huge audiences in both film and television. But whereas Alex P. Keaton of Family Ties taught a generation of youngsters about the perils of drugs, relaxing with pot or meth seems like no big deal for today's kids on That 70s Show or the film Go. And if even mild-mannered accountants on the Showtime series Weeds are getting stoned on a regular basis, can marijuana be that bad? Returning as my guest is Molly Mackeshin, a Chicago-area mental health professional and film blogger whose thoughts can be found at celluloitering.blogspot.com. Drugs and popular culture, up next on Under Surveillance. Good morning and welcome to another edition of Under Surveillance on WLUW. My name is Kevin Fulham, and today I'm happy to be joined by Molly Mackeshin, a Chicago-area mental health professional and a film blogger whose thoughts can be found at celluloitering.blogspot.com. Welcome back to the show, Molly.
Thank you for having me back, Kevin.
So today on the show, we're going to be talking about the depiction of drug use in popular culture. Something that's come up certainly recently in terms of the kinds of shows that we're seeing on TV now. We've got Weeds, which has just ended its third season, I believe, on Showtime.
Yes.
And we had That 70s Show on for about an 8 or 9 year run on Fox TV. Both of these shows really depicting marijuana use in a much more benign light than we've seen otherwise throughout the years in film and television. So starting with a show like Weeds, the show features Mary Louise Parker. She's this 40-ish-year-old woman who is in a very affluent suburb of California. And at the beginning of the show, her husband has unexpectedly died. And she's got to raise two kids. She's got to support herself. So she turns to selling marijuana to her neighbors, basically. And these are all very seemingly ordinary kind of people. They have stable jobs. You know, Kevin Nealon's on the show as this accountant. He's just, you know, totally stoned the whole time. Was there any kind of backlash when Weeds first came out?
Surprisingly, no. And I was looking into this last night because I was hoping to be able to find some articles backlashing against Weeds. But surprisingly, there was very little press reacting against the show. Maybe that's because it's on Showtime, and Showtime's kind of notorious for having programming that pushes the envelope. The show isn't really about drug use so much as it's about drug dealing and about suburbia. It's a critique of suburbia, if anything. And I think also, as you pointed out earlier, marijuana use on television is not particularly taboo or even controversial anymore. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, you know, by age 30, more than half of people in the United States have used marijuana, and something like 20% use on a regular basis. And by regular, I mean monthly. You know, I'm not talking about every day, but as you pointed out, a lot of the characters in Weeds are smoking. They're blazing up every week. You know, they're regular customers.
Or every day.
Every day in the case of Kevin Nealon's character or in Andy's character. But I think that while not everybody in the United States smokes on a regular basis, it is reflective of a general 25 to 40 demographic that television producers go for. I mean, college age and young professionals do engage in marijuana abuse on a regular basis.
We have Weeds. We had That 70s Show, which debuted, I think, back in 1998, starring Ashton Kutcher and Topher Grace. The show depicts life in the late 70s in a Wisconsin town. A large part of the show depicts the characters hanging out in the basement, and they're getting high.
And that's the great thing about the show, is that it's able to go back in time. And it does a good job of recreating the aesthetic and everything. It goes back in time, and it's able to show everything that was going on at the time, but that was not allowed to be shown on television. which I think is what's so interesting. But that was a controversial show when it first came out, the first two seasons. You know, they have the circle is what it's called in the show, where they pan around in the basement and they show all the kids and they're getting high and they're having, you know, asinine conversations about music or whatever. And it's obvious that they're all smoking pot, although it doesn't show them using marijuana. You see the smoke in the background. And I think that they actually had to stop showing the smoke because it was considered to be too inflammatory, pardon the pun, for Fox at the time. And I think that's the main difference that you see between cable television and network television. Like I said, Showtime, I mean, that's pretty much the bar for them to have a show like Weeds, where you show people using marijuana and selling drugs and having sex. That's cable, where the FCC has no real say. But on something like Fox, you know, it's Rupert Murdoch, and the FCC kind of tells them what to do. And while they like to push the envelope, they can't show as much as cable can. So that was kind of a problem at the time, to show all that smoke.
Well, I think the big difference, though, we have seen drugs used in the 70s and 80s on television, but you had drugs featured as a plot element to teach a lesson, like, hey, this is really bad, you kids shouldn't be doing this, as opposed to, it's no big deal, it doesn't have any kind of long-term
the immediate thing
effect.
I just thought of, Helen Hunt, when she was in the PCP After School Special. Have you ever seen that?
I have not. This is it's been probably mid-80s.
Yeah,
so.
I think it's actually early 80s, and it's before, okay. She was on, way before Mad About You and Twister and all that good stuff. But she takes a snort of PCP in her high school after class is over, and she jumps out of the window onto the ground and starts screaming, get them off me, you know. And everyone gathers around. And the moral is, don't do PCP, kids, or you'll jump out of a window like Helen Hunt.
So why do we see just more the acceptance of it now as opposed to 10 years ago, 15 years ago?
Well, I think there's been a huge backlash against the drug war. Our generation, I guess, we have the whole DARE thing is kind of a joke. It's kitschy. People wear DARE t-shirts as a joke now. You see parodies of the old anti-drug PSAs, and people like to make fun of that because they realize that they've been, well, not lied to. I'm not going to say that. But those old PSAs are very black and white. And they're very over the top. You know, you see a kid take a hit from a joint and then he, you know, kills his family or whatever. And that's kind of extreme. And now people are looking back at it and realizing, okay, you know, we were raised on this. It wasn't entirely true. And they're starting to rebel against it. At least that's kind of where I see it coming from.
We should probably take a look back in history in terms of a depiction of drug use throughout the years. Going back to the early half of the 20th century, you know, we had a film like Reefer Madness.
Reefer Madness was made in 1936, and it was funded by a church group that wanted to make children and teachers and parents aware of the dangers of cannabis use, you know, because the government at the time was stirring up a lot of propaganda against hemp and against marijuana. So this church group funded Reefer Madness, which was originally called Tell Your Children. And the film was bought up by a producer named Dwayne Esper, who is an exploitation filmmaker. He recut it with shots of that were more salacious, you know, sexual. There's a whole bunch of scenes of people going into bedrooms to have relations, and there's a whole bunch of scenes of people waving guns around and shooting each other because they're all high on marijuana. It makes them crazy. And it was actually redistributed as an exploitation film and renamed Reefer Madness. So in the end, this movie that was supposed to scare kids away from drugs and teach parents about what THC does to the brain was actually used to titillate the audience, which I think is an interesting reappropriation of material.
When it was originally produced, it was not widely available, right?
No, and then later it was sold on an exploitation circuit, along with, you know, films like The Cocaine Fiends and Marijuana, The Plant with Roots in Hell, that's another one. The Devil's Harvest, that's another one.
Well, there was the Hays Code in effect, and for a long time, filmmakers were not allowed to show drug use in any film.
And then
later on, during the 50s and 60s, they were allowed to show drugs as long as there were some sort of negative consequences.
Right. Like from 1934 to 1967, the Hays Code was in effect, and it got even stricter after 1951. When they decided that it wasn't quite being strict enough with sexual content. But you do see some drug movies like The Man with the Golden Arm, Days of Wine and Roses, Bigger Than Life, which is James Mason's hilarious anti-drug movie. But all those, as you pointed out, they show people using drugs and then having these horrible consequences. Or what's that movie, Monkey on My Back, which is about morphine addiction? Yeah, it's a lot of things, but they always show someone, you know, losing their family and ending up homeless or whatever. And then in 1967, when the Hays Code ended, you get to see this backlash. You know, part of the counterculture was that, you know, drugs open your mind, and that was reflected in films like Easy Rider or The Trip or was it I Love You, Alice B. Toklas.
So Easy Rider, you want to talk a little bit about that film?
Easy Rider stars Jack Nicholson and Peter Fonda, and it's about some guys that get on motorcycles and go across the country, and they join a commune, and they meet up with Jack Nicholson, and they all drop acid. There's a scene where they drop acid in a cemetery, and they have this, you know, weird, trippy sequence, and it shows acid as being a frightening but mind-expanding positive drug, and that the people that end up killing Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper in the end are kind of red-blooded American traditional people. And they just kill them because they're different. You know, and that's symbolic of, you know, what the counterculture was rallying against.
We had, a number of films in the 70s. We had Cheech and Chong, like a whole cottage industry, you know, made out of these slapstick pot movies. And it just kind of seen it as being a big joke. How about other films in the 70s? Well, we had the French Connection dealing with drugs from the view of law enforcement, certainly. But other films featuring drug use that came out during that time period.
One thing I can think of is Panic in Needle Park, which was a heroin movie. I think it was one of Al Pacino's earlier works where he plays a heroin junkie. That's a really sad and sadly a very realistic movie. Another one I can think of, I was telling you about earlier, is Blue Sunshine, which is a cheesy mystery about a bunch of kids who dropped acid in 1968. And then 10 years later, when the film was made in 1978, they find out that it was a bad batch of acid, and they all lose their hair and become homicidal maniacs. And to me, I think that's very representational of the attitude about how the counterculture had a backlash later. A decade later, we're starting to pay for all the drug use and sexual promiscuity. And there was a huge backlash against free love and everything that came back with the Reagan administration in the 80s. So
moving on from the 70s into the 80s, we had Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you know, where you have Sean Penn's Spicoli, surfer dude, you know, mm-hmm. just kind of happily stoned throughout the film. But then we come to the Reagan years. I mean, Reagan took office at the beginning of 1981, and Nancy Reagan, the first lady at that time, made it a very personal crusade to speak out against drug use, and especially with kids, especially using the media, using Hollywood to mm-hmm. disseminate this message.
Definitely. A whole bunch of programming, like regular networks, agreed to feature shows that would possess the Just Say No message, such as Different Strokes, The Cosby Show. You know, in 1970, Richard Nixon instructed his chief domestic officer, John Ehrlichman, to, here, I've got the quote here right now, further utilize television as a tool in the fight against drug use. And by that, they meant the government was going to subsidize entertainment in exchange for them to put anti-drug messages in their programming. And those shows were more than happy to step up and say, okay, we're going to put this, you know, in our plots, like the Mod Squad, Marcus Welby, MD, like Quincy, ME, Room 222, like all these shows agreed to have episodes. And this is pretty square programming, but everyone's watching it, so it does have some influence. You know, they agreed to put anti-drug programming. Jack Webb was a producer at the time, and he was actually pretty influential in making deals with the government to put anti-drug messages in programming. He was one of the original actors on Dragnet also. And when they brought Dragnet back in the late 60s, drugs were a big part of a lot of the plots. I don't know if anyone remembers that episode with the LSD where the hippie does too much acid and he becomes catatonic, and Joe Friday has this long soliloquy about how dangerous LSD is. So yeah, that started in the 70s and continued on with Nancy Reagan. She had a lot of pull, obviously, because of Ronald Reagan.
Sure, and that's when the whole Just Say No campaign was first introduced.
Exactly.
You had the after-school specials talking about the perils of drug use. Yes, at a lot of sitcoms at the time, TV shows, whether it's, you know, Family Ties talking about speed pills, or you mentioned Different Strokes as well, too.
Yeah, Different Strokes. And the Cosby Show episode with the joint.
With the parents finding a joint in Theo's textbook.
And who could forget the Saved by the Bell episode when Elizabeth Berkley gets hopped up on caffeine pills? I think in part, just on a brief tangent, that there's a different attitude towards drug addiction now than there was in the 80s. I don't know. It seems like now it's considered to be more, since we are such a victim culture, you know, you see a show like House where the main character is a pill popper. He's addicted to Vicodin, but he's not portrayed as being bad because he's addicted to Vicodin. He's portrayed as a victim because he's addicted to Vicodin. You know, and you don't see the drug users on television in the 80s particularly portrayed as being victims so much as they are perpetrators. And now it's kind of considered, oh, it's this burden I have to shoulder that I'm addicted to smack. Oh, woe is me.
People say the same thing about alcoholism, right? That it's a disease, right. You know, not an addiction. Oh, I have this disease. Yeah, so Nancy Reagan has really made this kind of a crux of her stay in office. I mean, that's really the most important thing that she was pushing for. In a similar vein, you had Tipper Gore a few years after Nancy pushing for the parental advisory labels that you now see on all the CDs that you buy.
Decency.
Exactly, exactly. So after the Nancy Reagan years, we had this wealthy philanthropist, right, who donated a large sum of money?
No, it wasn't. The actual Clinton administration, the drug czar, Barry McCaffrey, decided that it would be a good idea to buy up a bunch of ad space on major networks in order to put in public service announcements about drugs. And I think that you might have remembered, you know, that's when we started having the just tell them you were too busy getting high to watch the kid while he was falling into the pool and the meth ads, you know, the meth jingle and all that. But what happened was the government decided, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to give you $1 billion for all this ad space, but we're only going to take up half of it. And we're going to let you sell the other half to Microsoft and Sprint and AT&T and all that. But in exchange for giving you this half-priced advertising, you're going to have to put anti-drug themes in your programming, because the government assumed, and I think they're right, that we respond better to messages in programming than we do in ads. I mean, I don't know about you, but my brain kind of shuts off when I watch ads.
Sure.
Which is why product placement has become so popular recently versus just advertising. So they started having, you know, anti-drug plots in ER, in Chicago Hope, in Beverly Hills 90210, Seventh Heaven. I remember the Seventh Heaven anti-huffing episode, which was hysterically funny.
The paint thinner kind of stuff?
Yeah, they're like huffing spray paint, you know, like, come on, everyone's doing it. You know, it's hilarious. And I got that whole bit from Salon, if anyone wants to check up on that story and follow up online at salon.com. But I thought that was really interesting because it really shows how the government is controlling what we see and how much influence they've had from the 70s until the present. And how the cable companies now, because they are independent, are taking things into their own hands. And yeah, they do product placement, don't get me wrong, but they're able to have a little bit more freedom in the material that they show us.
I know that there are a number of advertisements that came out in the early 2000s where they talked about how if you're buying drugs, you're supporting the terrorism. Right?
Oh, yes, because if you're smoking pot, you know, what you're really doing is paying for Taliban guns. That is what you're doing. No, not
although
really.
We were paying for Taliban guns in the 80s, right? When they were fighting the Russians.
Yeah, actually, we were. And we put Saddam Hussein in power, but that's an entirely different story.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose that maybe some of the money that goes, you know, is going to some people somewhere, but I think that's one of probably the lowest possible techniques the government's ever taken to discourage drug use, is to say, well, remember 9/11, you know.
Yeah. But moving on into the 90s, we had a number of films dealing with law enforcement and drug use. You had films like New Jack City, which with Wesley Snipes portraying this crack dealer in New York City. And Chris Rock, young Chris Rock, who's addicted to crack as an undercover agent, and he gets himself killed. Can you think of anything else besides New Jack City?
Drugstore Cowboy?
Was it Matt Dillon?
Matt Dillon and Kelly Lynch, where they're pill poppers and they're addicted to heroin, and basically they completely fall apart. Their family falls apart. All they care about is drugs. You know, pretty typical sad story.
There's Goodfellas with Ray Liotta, and he deals coke and then winds up becoming his own best customer.
Right, and, exactly. Kids also features drug use. That was, what, 93?
That was 95,
like that.
I believe. Okay. And, you know, and actually, Kids, we talked about it on a previous show, not you and I, but there's a show that I did on teen films, talking about how you saw drug use in terms of teen films and films like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and then that disappeared in the 80s. But then now you see that, you know, it's kind of reappearing, certainly over the last decade or so, whereas violence is now taboo because of Columbine. You know, there were a lot of films in the early 90s dealing with violent kids, violent high schools, you know, Jews and Boys in the Hood and those kinds of films. But then you have a film, say a film like Go, that came out in the late 90s, where the main characters are dealing ecstasy or doing ecstasy, and it's played very much for a comedic effect. Mm-hmm. There doesn't seem to be any kind of real negative consequences involved with using the drug. Now, how is public view ecstasy as opposed to marijuana, as opposed to harder drugs?
I can't really speak for the public, but I think that there's a general association of ecstasy with middle class and upper middle class white people. And it's viewed as kind of a club drug, and it's not viewed as being a dangerous urban threat in the same way that crack and heroin are. And in that way, I think it's easier to make light of it. I certainly think that ecstasy, like any drug, has its dangers. But because of the class issue and because it is so popular with college kids and with that demographic that go to see movies and watch television, that's what enables them to play it for comic effect. You know, but something like Requiem for a Dream, it takes, you know, something that's easy to make into a scary subject like heroin and, I guess, powder cocaine.
Before we talk about my name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm here with Molly Makishin, and we're talking about the depiction of drug use in film and television throughout the years. Requiem for a Dream, which I actually just wound up seeing maybe a couple of weeks ago, came out in the year 2000. Darren Aronofsky,
yes.
I believe, was a director, and features Jared Leto, Jennifer Connelly, and Marlon Wayans. And I think just one of the most powerful films that I've seen, I think, ever. You know, it's very, very sad, very frightening story of these three individuals who are just involved in this downward spiral of addiction.
Well, don't forget Ellen Burstyn.
There's Ellen Burstyn, who plays the mother of one of the drug addicts. She's addicted to television and addicted to watching these self-help shows. She gets this call one day saying that, hey, she's invited to go on television, and she's trying to fit into this red dress. She can't fit in. She's gained too much weight. So one of her friends suggests that she goes to the doctor, and the doctor gives her amphetamines, basically, speed pills. And that's all she winds up taking. She doesn't eat. She's just taking uppers in the morning and downers to go to sleep. And after about a month of this, the refrigerator starts growling at her, you know, yeah. right? I mean, yeah. the TV, you know, images come out from a TV. It's very, very frightening in terms of point of view, drug addict type of scene.
You know, when I watch that movie, I always focus on the old woman's character and her amphetamine addiction because, you know, I think that we are so permissive in American culture with pill popping as being kind of like a lesser crime or a lesser severity to inflict on the body, because you think, okay, heroin, oh, that's really bad. You know, you see Jared Leto shooting up and he's shooting up into like already collapsed surface veins, and it's really gross and it's horrible, and he gets septicemia, you know. But then you have his mother who's taking something that a doctor prescribes, and you think, okay, a doctor prescribes it, how bad can it be? But she ends up with amphetamine psychosis. Granted, that's a very rare side effect of overusing amphetamines, but it does happen, and it happens, you know, more often than we usually see in film and on television. So I really like the fact that they actually showed the other side of what happens when you abuse prescription. I mean, like, this is one of the things that I don't like about shows like Will and Grace, where they play up the pill popping for laughs. Like, Karen Walker's character is always popping, you know, benzos or whatever, and she's always talking about how she needs a drink. That's never criticized. You know, they criticize a little pot smoking, but they don't criticize that. And I don't think we really consider how dangerous prescription drug abuse can be too at the same time. So I like that aspect of the film, definitely.
That's something that's come up in the last 10 years in general. I mean, we have the kids who are hooked on Ritalin. You know, we have people hooked on Vicodin. Rush Limbaugh, wasn't he hooked on Vicodin or on painkillers?
He was hooked on
Oxycontin.
Yeah.
Okay. And that became a whole big story. Brett Favre, I think, might have been hooked on Vicodin, I think. And yeah, because it's off the streets. It's someone in a position of authority telling us that, hey, it's okay to use these drugs.
Right.
There's no violence associated with it. You know, it's not like people are battling over corners the way they are in, say, HBO's The Wire program, you know. So, you know, no gunfire being exchanged. And certainly Ellen Burstyn, she's seen as being very naive. She's an elderly woman. She's all alone. All she has for companionship is this television. And one of the things that Darren Aronofsky, the director, said is that it's not necessarily a film about drugs. It's about addiction in general. And we talked about ecstasy being portrayed in a more benign light, certainly marijuana. How about any films portraying more serious drug use, cocaine, heroin, crack, in a benign light?
Cocaine, I think, this is something I was thinking about earlier today. Cocaine often gets shown as a party drug, and I think drugs are often used in period pieces to mark the time. I was thinking about this because I was watching Summer of Sam recently. I don't know if you've seen that. Spike Lee's really awesome portrayal of that one summer, and I think 77, during the blackouts when everyone was afraid of the Son of Sam. Basically, it shows all these characters, you know, at CBGB and the early punk rock movement and disco and everything. And everyone's doing coke. Like, everyone's doing coke. And it's portrayed in a fairly light way because that's just what people did back then. And I think, and something like Blow, a film like Blow with Johnny Depp, I mean, really, the crux of that film was the dealing, not the coke use. Now, it was treated as kind of a light thing, too. Depending on, I think in period pieces for the 70s and 80s, cocaine was the drug of choice, so you're going to see a lot of that.
Carlito's Way. With Al Pacino.
Sure. Right. Acid, of course, is the drug of choice and associated with the 60s, so you're going to see that in period films. Well, you see a movie like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, where hallucinogens are treated as being kind of light. You know, mescaline isn't so bad. You know, ether.
Talk a little bit about that film.
Oh, that, maybe that's an extreme example, but that's Hunter S. Thompson's novel, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, was turned into a film directed by Terry Gilliam of the Monty Python troupe, starring Johnny Depp and Christina Ricci and Benicio del Toro as the lawyer friend. And they do lots and lots and lots of acid and mescaline and ether, and they drink, and they basically just go on a week-long bender in Las Vegas, and they see all sorts of things. And it is treated as being, you know, I guess fairly comic in nature.
One of the things I forgot to talk about, just the use of drugs in films that depict mental health facilities, drugs as a form of control.
Oh.
You see this in One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest.
Right.
You see this in THX 1138, the George Lucas film. You also have it in Sopranos recently, where during one of the episodes, someone's trying to tell Junior Soprano to stop taking his medicine because that's impairing his mental faculties.
Right.
But you see this as, hey, you got to stop taking the pills in order to get free. I mean, this runs through any kind of program where the mental health facility is portrayed in a very negative light, which is quite often. You know,
mm-hmm.
Why do you think it makes for an effective villain?
Well, I suppose it's got that idea, Ken Kesey-like idea from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that the hospital represents the man, and you have to free your mind by breaking out of the chains of whatever drug haze that you're in and live life on your own terms. You know, it's one more authoritarian figure to overcome, right?
Terminator 2 as well, Sarah Connor.
Terminator 2, she gets out. Well, that's, you know, there aren't a lot of hospitals that are actually like that. But in real life, sometimes you have to use Thorazine to control violent people. It's an unfortunate reality.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and I've been joined today by Molly Makishin, who is a Chicago area mental health professional and is also the author of Celluloitering. And that's a film blog that can be found at celluloitering.blogspot.com. And thank you so much, Molly, for coming back on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Kevin.
For Molly Makishin, my name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW. For more information or to listen to archived shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. That's www.undersurveillance.org.